Let's have an AA meeting.
Let's have one.
My name is Isla. I am an alcoholic. I am so grateful to be sober today. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their life. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them. I must have this thing. I am delighted to introduce to you Todd N. He's from the Happy Hour Group in Buford. Just because he is like a master fisherman, he promised to tell the truth, the whole truth. Welcome, Todd.
My name's Todd. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Todd.
And, you know, I was thinking about this, and Derek kind of pulled me into it. It's like my favorite thing to do, but I've done it enough to know that when you're asked, you just say yes. The way down here, I kind of try to invite God into this process, and we'll see what he's got to say. Not a circus speaker, so it's a little different every time. I want to say thank you to NABA. You know, I was talking about this before the meeting. NABA's kind of like the blue chip staple of what, I don't even like to call it a clubhouse because it's a lot bigger than that, but it's like all the little, what the little clubhouses want to be when they grow up. And, you know, the blue chip group is a staple. You know, it is what it is. So thank you guys for inviting me to come down and share for a few minutes. Y'all know this is an AA meeting, right? I want to make sure nobody's in the wrong place tonight. Not Boy Scouts, not Girl Scouts, not small group. So we're going to try to stay awake. I know it's the day after Super Bowl, so we try to keep this semi-entertaining. Just as a quick show of hands, this is the participation portion of the program. I want to ask y'all something. I want you, like, you know, if you can relate, like, just stick up your hand, okay? I want to make sure I'm in the right place. You know, when it comes to, like, qualifiers, I think back to drinking, like, there was the fun phase. And the fun phase for me was, like, you know, I took a drink, call it a drink, drug, whatever, you know, insert yours. My favorite drug was anything you had. You know, alcohol just happened to be there at the beginning and the end. But when I took it, you know, I felt, like, taller, smarter, funnier, better looking, a little easier to talk to. You know, basically it's like the whole world just came into focus. Anybody relate to that? And even though the ill effects for me the first time weren't, you know, they were pretty costly, I still couldn't wait to do it again. I kind of like to think about that as alcohol doing for me. You know, but quickly alcohol started doing to me. I call that the trouble phase. We'll see if we can relate here. Anybody ever give up a relationship for a drink? I hear it said all the time is like alcohol. When I was in treatment, I had to write this thing about a breakup letter to alcohol. And I wrote all this stuff about alcohol cost me this and alcohol cost me that. And it took the girl I loved, it took the job. And I heard somebody say it real eloquently is that everything I graciously laid upon the altar of alcoholism. Alcohol never took a thing from me. I gave it up willingly. If you've ever gave up a relationship for a drink, I can relate to you. Anybody ever traded a job for their next drink? All right, so we're cool. I mean, I want to make sure we're in the right place. Anybody ever had trouble with the law? There we go. This is a class favorite. You know, I heard a saying one time that it said that, you know, it wasn't that every time I drank that I got in trouble. But ironically, every time I got in trouble, alcohol and drugs seemed to be involved. Anybody know the difference between tickets and charges? Anybody ever get charges while they were drinking? All right. So they get harder from here. Anybody ever had a DUI? Okay. Any habitual violators in the house? Okay. Anybody habitual violator by the age of 21? There you go. That's you, my girl. Okay. All right. And here's the bonus question. Anybody ever been pulled over by a fire truck or any other non-police vehicle? That's my girl. Mine was a fire truck. There you go. All right. All right, so now that I'm convinced we're all in the right place, let's just get down to business. I grew up, so my sobriety date is April the 24th, 1990, which I don't know if that means much to y'all, but it tickled just the hell out of my parents. Speaking of which, you know, I had two normal parents. They both worked. They provided for us. You know, I never had too much, but I never went without. I remember my first drink, you know, it was at the skating rink, you know. I actually grew up, I'm from Flowery Branch. I live up at the lake now, but I grew up in Decatur. You know, my high school was Towers High School. I grew up at Glenwood in 285, and this is in the 70s and 80s. And I was the minority. You know, in this place back in the day off Wesley Chapel, it's called the Golden Glass Skating Rink, and I went in there one night, and we snuck out, and some buddies of mine and me, we all split a 12-pack of beer, and it was like magic. Everything changed when I went back in there. And I chased that for the rest of my drinking, that cunning, baffling, and powerful stuff. When you get sober when you're 21, there's not a lot of the drunk log that you can still remember. To sum it up, I mean, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll pretty much tell you everything you need to know about my alcohol and drug abuse. You know, I embraced all three equally. The alcohol and drugs, it was an instant love affair. The drugs are a part of the story, very brief. When you're 15, 16 years old, drug dealers don't card. It's a lot harder to go down and buy a 12-pack than it is a quarter ounce. And when somebody, you know, for a while there, somebody would ask me, it was like, how do you get sober when you're 21? The direct answer was that cocaine did for me in a year what alcohol couldn't have did in 10. I mean, it was just, it was bad. Got my first DUI when I was 17. You get them under 18 back then, they'd suspend your license. My girl. I got a qualifier for you. Anybody ever in the process of getting your third DUI and you give the guy your ticket for your second? My people. All right. That's always a qualifier. And, you know, when they let me out of jail that day, the guy, I remember this guy, and he says, you know, I know you can legally drive, but if I catch you driving in my town, I'm going to lock you up and nobody's going to get you out. You know, society was pretty much done with me at 21. When I was in jail for my second DUI, it was just me and one other guy in the jail cell. And this is kind of how I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is two parts. It's the relationship with God and it's the fellowship. You know, it's three parts of a triangle and stuff. But when I was pretty early at this, I mean, I went to jail one night and I was drunk. You know, that's different than just being a little drunk. Yeah. All right, and I was drunk. You know, I was facing backwards on 85. I was southbound in a northbound lane. Cop comes up the window, taps on the window. I roll the window down, tell him I'm drunk, take me to jail. He tells me that he's off duty, but he can call somebody to help me out. And he did. You know, I don't know about y'all, but I'll give you a fun fact. If you see more than, if only one cop's there, you got a chance. If two show up, you're going to jail. That's just statistics. But I was in jail and I was crying the blues, like, oh man, I gotta quit drinking. I gotta quit. You know, this is killing me. It's done cost me a job. And he listened to me for a while and he says, you know, he says, God can fix that. I'm like, yeah. Like, I'll do anything, man. I don't care. He says, well, we can pray about it and God will relieve that obsession. Oh yeah, I'm in. And he says, but I got to warn you. He says, we can do that. And if God does, he says, if you drink again, you'll drink like you never drank before. And we said the prayer and did the deal. And I went, my mom finally got me out. I went home, went to sleep, woke up about lunchtime or whatever it was. Both parents got a job. So they're at work. Car's an impound. And ain't nobody going to be home until like 6 o'clock. Now, I didn't want to take a drink. But there was a half gallon of rum underneath my couch. I had plenty of time, didn't know what else to do. I didn't have a solution. I just had God. I drank. And for the next 4 or 5 months, I drank like I never drank before. I crossed lines I swore I'd never cross. And it was bad. My mom took me to my first meeting up at this place called the Hawk Club in Gainesville in 1989. In this little building. And I don't know about y'all. I know the qualifier. Anybody in the house a chameleon? You know, like, you know, you can blend in anywhere you go. Okay. So I went to this AA meeting, and I'm only going because my mom's making me go or I ain't staying there that night. I only had about 4 or 5 beers in me. I didn't want to show up like drunk or nothing. I won't be a hypocrite. But I had zero interest in getting sober. I just want to stay at my parents' house that night. I walk up the stairs about 8:05 for an 8 o'clock meeting, and there's probably as many people as this in a room much smaller than this. And everybody in there has got a cup of coffee and they're smoking a cigarette. I don't drink coffee and I don't smoke cigarettes, but being the chameleon that I am, I immediately walked to the back of the place, got a cup of coffee, sat in the back row and bummed a cigarette because I'm going to blend in. And that was the longest hour of my life, y'all. I couldn't tell you anything they said. All I knew is that if I didn't get home quick enough, my dad was going to drink the rest of the beer before I got home. That's a problem in my world. But what it did is it told me that if I ever wanted to address a problem that I was unwilling to acknowledge that I had, that there was a place to go. And another fun fact, I stayed for like 20-some-odd days, and I would tell y'all how good it was since I started hanging out with you. You got to listen to what people say. Because I would tell, you know, when they sent me upstairs to a newcomers meeting, I was a little mad about that because I knew they was talking about me downstairs. And I knew I couldn't hang out more than 30 days because I'd never stopped drinking. I was just telling you how much better it had gotten since I started hanging out with y'all. But I was drinking every day. I went to treatment, you know, one night, my last drunk, middle pretty much a blackout. I kind of come to the conclusion that if I kept doing what I was going to do, I wasn't going to see another birthday. Simple God help me prayer. Long and the short of it was my dad comes downstairs, says, you're going to work today. And when they finally drew blood for me the next morning, I was still .22 drunk. And out of my mouth, and that wasn't even like drunk. And out of my mouth comes, I think I'm going to go get some help. And I went upstairs, I put on some clothes, went upstairs, told my mom if she'd take me somewhere, I'd go. A few years ago, my mom heard me tell that story, and she says, that's not what you said. I mean, who are you going to believe? And she goes, well, I'm like, what'd I say? And she goes, well, you told me that if you didn't take me somewhere right now that I was going to die. .22 drunk. Who are you going to believe? I went to treatment. Anybody in here less than a year sober? Okay. Y'all, this part of the story is for y'all. Anybody like more than like a decade sober? All right. The rest of it will be for y'all, so hang out. In treatment, there was 12 of us in treatment. They said two of y'all be sober in a year. And I looked down the room, and she was prettier, and he was smarter, and that one was younger. And I wouldn't have bet you I'd stay sober a day out of treatment. But I was willing. And in retrospect, I looked back on it, and I did everything they told me to do. They said, you need to stay for a while. They said, you need to go to halfway house. You need to go to outpatient. You need to go to aftercare. Back then, the treatment center I went to was pretty open door. My dad I'd go to work with my dad. He would drop me off at the treatment center at like 4 o'clock. They had a pool table I could play on for free. I'd hang out until the meeting. My mom come pick me up at 9:30, and I did it every day for a couple of years. You know, on Sunday nights, it was just me and the patient, stuff like that. And, through the years, I would go, well, why'd I get it and the other 10 didn't? Well, of course I got it. I did everything they told me to do. You know, back then, they didn't want so much on suggestions. They just kind of told you stuff. So if I had a suggestion for you, it's just find in your vocabulary the word okay. When somebody suggests something, is probably to the betterment of your survival. Just say okay. My first 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was pretty much on fire for the program. Once the state of Georgia deemed me worthy to drive a car, I was all over meetings. I helped set up a meeting one time, workshops. My first workshop, for those that are older, was on the Friday night speaker was Bill Roop. The Saturday night speaker was Jimmy Smith. And the Sunday morning speaker was Father Noel Burtonshaw. And by the time I got through on Sunday, Charlie could have, you know, basically they poured what was left of me back into his little truck, and we drove me back home. And I came away with the conclusion of how much bigger Alcoholics Anonymous was and how little I actually comprehended about it. If Alcoholics Anonymous is only big as your clubhouse or this clubhouse, go try something different. I had the privilege of, a few years ago, the International came to town, and me and my daughter went and drove the train down to the International, and on Sunday morning, you know, my daughter had the opportunity to say the Lord's Prayer with about 40,000 drunks. The first 10 years, I would almost, like I said, that was kind of like the honeymoon period with me and AA. And I was on fire. I did everything. The next 20 years was a little different. I would call that more of that maintenance AA mode because life catches up with you. You know, I wound up going back to school. I don't know about y'all, but I had trouble in school when I was using. You know, like I went to college but couldn't pass a remedial math class at the college level. You know, when I decided about 3 years sober and I decided that I was going to go back to school, I graduated with my degree and I'd made all A's and two B's. You know, same guy. Just a different brain. But during that time, you know, I was embarking in a career in insurance, traveling. My first 10, 15 years in recovery, I spent most of my time driving up and down the East Coast playing pool for money. Old timers, thumpers or whatever, they would tell me that I couldn't do that and stay sober. And I told them I'd read the book. Because the book says I can go anywhere and do anything as long as my motives are right. I was there to play pool, not to live vicariously through others. Okay. And I stayed sober. I had a great time. What a great, it was almost like being a teenager all over again for a decade. You know, I have any responsibilities, I had a little bit of money in my pocket, I had a driver's license, and I rode. For me, it was like, you know, if my world was just going to be as big as my county, then I'm selling my program short. But the next 20 years was like jobs and kids and raising kids. Anybody got kids? Oh, my God, what little life suckers they are, right? I mean, all of a sudden, 8 o'clock meetings, are you kidding? You know, everything's a challenge. You know, you got to get up early, take them somewhere, pick them up, clean them up, feed them, study them, get them into bed, do it again tomorrow. And that lasts for like 20 years. It was kind of maintenance. Say, hey, I sat in the same meeting with the same people, for the most part, sat in the same chair, shared the same message, and wondered why I wasn't really comfortable where I was at in my program. There's some things, there's like some warnings in the book, like job or no job, wife or no wife, but it says we'll stay sober through all that. I've tested all those like in 2 times. I've been married and divorced. I've been, you know, I've changed careers in recovery. What I really want to talk about is like the last 3 years. We were talking about this before the meeting. We were talking about COVID. And COVID changed everything. You know, up until COVID, I'd went to a meeting, probably 2 to 3 meetings a week for 30 years. This gal I heard talk one time, she talked about sometimes if we fail to enlarge our spiritual life, then we kind of learn to stay sober on tricks. You know, some people's tricks are that they make the coffee. Like every Monday night, you know, old Bob's going to be there making the coffee. And that's Bob's gym. And there's nothing wrong with that. And Bob will probably stay sober making coffee. But the problem is, what happens when you take Bob's coffee away from him? You know, I'm not here to blaspheme, or I don't want to dog on AA or nothing like that, but we have conversations about like AA checklists. I have a home group. That was mentioned. I have a sponsor. I sponsor people. But honestly, I don't know if that puts me in good standings with the A or not, because I've never seen anybody keep the score. So to use those as qualifiers, I don't know. I think that's what it means to me. All right. But I do those things. And I do it because, I have a service position, because I want to be engaged. COVID kind of changed everything. It was mentioned I am a member of the Easy Does It Bass Club. I would be remiss if I didn't say that. Hoorah. And these old birds have been sober anywhere from days to decades. They know how to practice these principles in all their affairs. And when COVID hit, my trick was going to meetings. I didn't go to but 2 meetings that year for like better than a year. My trick's been took away from me. And I spent probably 2-3 days a week on the boat with one of these old timers, and we talked about the fellowship, and we talked about life and solutions and stuff like that. So I wasn't doing any step work, and I wasn't working with newcomers, and I wasn't making no Bob coffee or any of that stuff. And it's kind of like, is this really all there is? About 2-2.5 years ago, I went to the Atlanta Roundup, and I heard this gal share. And she's about the same length of sobriety, and she's about my age and stuff. And she was talking about how, well, 2 things. First thing she said that got my attention was she said that she let God fill her calendar. Left her own devices. All she wanted to do is sit home, watch reruns on TV. She said that unless she can have a legitimate reason to say no to something, she says yes to everything. And she's talking about how the amazing places that had brought her into, and all the things in her life that she would have never picked, but they were, like, phenomenal. But during that same talk, she talked about being in a suicidal depression and double-digit sobriety. She said that her solution to that was she made like a newcomer, and she doubled down on her recovery. She basically went to more meetings, found a service position, went through the steps again, and really just got serious. Like I said, about that same time is where I'm sitting here wondering, like, is this all there is to recovery? Is I'm just going to tread this water? I'm just going to be maintenance? Pool player, non-drunk buddy of mine, uses an analogy that says, even God can't drive a parked car. You know, I never forgot that one. And he told me that a long time ago. You know, about this time, I told myself that, you know, I was willing. When I first got sober, I felt like me and God, we kind of cut a deal. And the deal was is that if I wouldn't drink or do no dope, if I would bring a big shovel and dream, that all of my dreams would materialize. And that's been my experience, but all of them have required effort. You know, anybody thinks they're just going to come into this program, sit down for an hour, and all of a sudden their life's going to get magically better, you might want to talk to somebody after the program, because that wasn't my experience. About that same time, I'm a fisherman. Saturdays are for fishing, and this one particular Saturday was a pretty nice day, and I went to Athens and picked this guy up, this newcomer. He was in a halfway house, and I drove him to a picnic in Duluth, a newcomer's picnic. That was me bringing the shovel. I show up at the picnic with a newcomer, and I leave with another one. They did a countdown and stuff, and this guy got the big book. And long and story short is that I've I've had the privilege of working with that guy for about a year and some change now, and he picked up here, you know, a few months ago. But at the same time, for me, it was like, you know, God, I've been here for so long. Either I already should know it, or, you know, or I mean, it's just the arrogance of long-term sobriety is a double-edged sword to me. It's like, God, no, I ain't drinking. I ain't giving up all that time. And then at the second token, it's like, well, what are you doing to protect that sobriety? So the DCM was there, and he was leading the show. And I walked up to him, and I introduced myself, and I was like, hey, I'm Todd, and, you know, I've been around a while or whatever. And I'm like, if there's anything I can do, let me know. And in my mind, my idea of that was that he's going to ask me to pass out cups or something like that. And I don't know about it. I don't think anybody's ever been assigned that job in AA in all the time that I've been here. But that was kind of my idea. It's like, don't give me anything really hard or really in-depth, but I really want to be involved. I've had the privilege of being that guy's sponsor for the last year. About that same time was happening this stuff, about a year ago. Like I said, our little clubhouse up in Buford, it went through a little flood. And went through a little, I don't know if y'all ever had any controversy down here. I'm sure this is a super smooth running building, you know, but up there we had a little controversy. You can let some personalities get in the way and stuff like that. And you know, we had some changing of the guard. And again, I'm on this kick about if, you know, if I can't legitimately say no, I'm going to say yeah. And somebody says, hey, you think it'd be a good idea if Todd was a board member? And so they voted that in. And I'm like, that was like 3 years of commitment. I'm like, I just want to pass out cups. But because of that, they voted in this lady as the president. We had a flood last December. Pipes broke, and basically the place got flooded out. And I was spending a great deal of time with this lady. She's in before the meeting. There's certain people in this program, like I've been around a while. I know the words we use, but there's some people that speak a language that's just not familiar to me. You know, I think Lois talked about that, you know, language of the heart. There was this lady that she was working with the girls, you know, some of the girls, and I'm pretty good friends with one of the ladies she was sponsoring, and she's taking her through the steps and stuff like that. And at 32 years, I'm looking around going, I ain't done that. I don't know how to do it that way. Because we were in close contact, and I understand all the stigma of AA and the dogma and everything else, and it was like, you know, it was like, I was desperate. I was, you know, I've had two windows of willingness in recovery. That was the one that got me to a treatment center and the one I experienced about a year ago. And I'm like, will you take me through the steps? And bless her heart, she would never say no. And I asked her like four times. And finally she says, well, let's just see what that looks like. You know, and the first thing she did was she sends me to dinner with her husband. And her husband sends me home with an online internet series from Andy Stanley on how to be the person that your person would want to be with. See, because when I was asking her, you know, and I was sort of forthright, when I was asking her to take me through the steps, I told her, I said, listen, I said, you know, I said, it's been a while, you know, been here. I said, you know, I said, you know, maybe I need a little refresher course. And by the way, I'm having a little trouble with relationships. Can't just seem to get into a healthy one. And, oh, by the way, I'd really like to share some of this information with the fellas. You know, you guys, and by the way, the ladies do it better. I'm sure that'll hurt some guys' feelings, but what I've done in the last year doesn't represent anything of what I've done in the previous 30. But she finally says, yeah, we get it. We get started. But again, pretty arrogant. My idea was that this whole process will take about 2 weeks because I've been here for a while. When we got started, I was headed to the Florida Men's Workshop, and we sat down after the meeting, and she shows up with a worn-out big book, a worn-out 12 and 12, and some worksheets. I showed up with a smile, and I'm pretty smart, and I immediately realized how I dramatically underassessed this situation. And on the way to Florida, I stop at a Dollar General and get a composition notebook, which I hadn't bought since I was in college. And I spent the majority of the weekend in the hotel room writing first step stuff. I'm like, I got this one. I've been sober 30 plus years. All the self-discovery of the unmanageability of my life that happened that weekend was a foundation that took me through the rest of this, you know, to the steps to this point. Or when we got to the fourth step, and again, you know, she's a woman and I'm a man, and now it's getting a little, you know, this is where it gets a little tricky, right? So we got through the fourth step, and on the fourth step, she suggests that I think about everybody that I've ever come in contact with in my life. And she said, picture them walking through that door over there, and what's your reaction? If it's positive, super. If it's anything less than positive, they go on the list. That was a different dynamic for me. I've never quite done it that way. So there's a lot of people, and I'm just writing a lot of names down. Her point to the story was, when she suggested that, was that I don't know about y'all, but logic is like my kryptonite. You know, if you hit me with some logic, then I usually, I'm like, okay, you know, back to the basics. And her point to the story was that two things can't occupy the same place. And if you've got something that you've been hiding up in there, you know, a little uncomfortable ability, then that's an area of your life that God can't get into. That's a little part of your soul that God can't reach. So I'm like, okay, that's logical. Two things can't occupy the same spot at one time. So I put a lot of things down on my four step that I had never even thought of in previous go arounds. And when we got to the fifth step, though, this is when it gets a little trickier, right? So she says, I'm going to pray on it. She says, I think we're going to get somebody else involved. She sends me up to a guy that I've known for a long time. You know, I'm walking, I told Neil what I'd done up to this point, and we're walking through this, you know, he's listening to my fifth step stuff, and I'm giving it to him pretty good, and we got to the end of it, and he goes, okay, he goes, well, this is normally where I just get out the book, and we go through six and seven, you know, both paragraphs, and we say the prayer, and you're on eight. And I knew what, I was like months into it, and we're only on five, so I got back to, you know, to my gal, and I looked at it, and I said, I got great news. I said, we knocked out that fifth step stuff. And by the way, while we were there, we went ahead and worked on through six and seven. And Neil says, I'm on eight. And she looks at me and she says, that's cute. You know, she's like, that's cute. She says, I thought we'd have a recap on five. You know, and we sat in the six and seven for months. For months. And I'm looking for, you know, I ain't quite convinced that I can't get like at least the two, like the six-month version of this, you know, like what happened to the two-week version. And I was in a meeting one day, and this gal says that, you know, in six and seven, we've identified all these character defects. She's like, if there's not a gap between seven and nine, how do you not know that you're apologizing for the same things that you're still doing? Logic. I can't argue with logic. So from then on out, I pretty much just shut up. You know, whatever they tell me to do and when, I do it. You know, when we got to eight, you know, before I got to nine, when we got to eight, she made me put everybody on note cards. You know, person on the front, the business on the back, and we divided them into three piles. You know, I can understand clear-cut directions. You know, when it came to the amends, I had two things that I put on a list that I'd never told anybody ever. Since we're in the city, you know, again, grew up in Decatur, there might have been this incident at this high school after hours where there might have been some borrowing of school property. Maybe. And I had looked for months to avoid to make this amends because there is no card. Online I check and I check, and finally I broke down and I just went to the school. And I had a check in my pocket. And I walk into the principal's office. I walk into the reception place. They call the principal. He comes out. He goes, oh, did you see the thing we posted online today? The fundraiser? And I'm like, huh? I'm like, no, man. And he says, oh, yeah, we're taking all the better students to get them out of DeKalb County and show them that there's a bigger world. We're taking them on a tour of like 30 colleges. It's going to take 2 days. And he's telling me this story. And he's fired up. And I'm listening to the whole story because I'm making an amends. And the short version is that I handed him a check. And he looks at the check and he goes, that's the exact amount that it takes to send one of these kids on this whole tour. Exact amount. It's an amends I've been meaning to make for about 40 years. My sister, she's a shrink. She lives up in D.C. I called her and I was like, hey, we probably need to book a little time because she's helped me through, you know, this last year. And I tell her a story about this thing that had happened. She, you know, now I'm barely getting it out of my mouth. And she goes, I know exactly what you're talking about. I know exactly who you're talking about. And I know exactly what happened because it happened to me too. And I listened to her talk for like 45 minutes. And at the end of the conversation, I felt a shift in a relationship, and it had brought me and her closer together. And at the end of the conversation, she's thanking me for giving her a platform that she had never had because she had never told anybody in the family because she didn't feel like it was safe. That kid that I mentioned, she's about to finish up her bachelor's. She's applied for her master's. You know, she's been accepted for her master's program. I get to walk her down the aisle in April. She's 21 years old. She's never seen her daddy take a drink. But she's been to a lot of AA meetings. You know, from the time she was in the car seat. Up through her teens. I pray she never has this disease. But if she does, I hope that those times spent in AA with her dad, that she knows that there's a safe place. You know, that this isn't a curse, really. It's probably the best thing that ever happened in my life. When I can get out of the way and I can give God a blank slate, the sky's the limit. You know, I'm limited by my little ideals. And I can tell you this, I've never had something happen to me. Any plan I've ever came up for me has always paled in comparison to what God's plan for me was if I would just let it happen. I hope you guys have found this kind of, you know, hopefully entertaining. Hopefully nobody fell asleep. I'd really like to kind of challenge each of y'all. You know, if you're early in the program, make this the most important thing in your life. You know, we make time for the things that are most important to us. If you've been here a while, maybe I encourage you to look at this thing with a fresh set of glasses, a new perspective. I did. And it's paid some dividends. I'll close with two things. We read the promises in every meeting. Some of the more clever meetings, they read a different set of promises. You know, in the 4 to the 12 and 12, it says AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. That kind of says it all, doesn't it? I don't know about y'all. I had this little piece of paper. When I got here, the treatment center says, write down everything you want to get out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had two requests. I want to stop hurting, and I would have really preferred not to go to jail. You know, I've hurt plenty through the years, and I still went to jail. Hell, I picked up my 9-month chip in jail, sober. You know, my sponsor at the time says, well, look at it like this, Bubba. You're making some amends. You got off light. At least you know why you're there. And if you don't do it no more, you won't go back. Again, logic. My favorite story in the big book is Keys to the Kingdom. And a little bit of the last part of the passage says, the last 15 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments because that is life. But also I have known a great deal of joy and a peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people I am truly related, first through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach. That ache is gone and never need returned again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we've been given the keys to the kingdom. I'll end with this. Probably my 3rd, 4th, 5th, 10th, 20th time down to Rock Eagle, whatever it was for the men's workshop, there was this guy and he's dead now. So his name was Creighton Pendarvis. That's just one you don't forget. But he used this analogy, and he held up a key ring, and he had a bunch of keys on it. And he starts labeling off these keys. He says, you know what? This one right here, this one unlocks my house. He says, this one will get me into the office. He says, this one's to my wife's car. He says, this one's, you know, the same key I gave my daughter to get in the house. And he starts labeling all these different aspects of his life. And he says, and the only common denominator, the only thing that they all have in common is the ring that holds them together. And he says, the ring represents Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. You know, without Alcoholics Anonymous, without y'all, all the keys are lost. They're scattered in the wind, and I'll never be able to keep them together. But with y'all, hell, this stuff's easy. Thank y'all for letting me speak.
That is awesome, awesome. Thank you, thank you. There were so many times I wanted to raise my hand again, and then you finish in with that paragraph and the foreword to the 12 and 12. That sums it up for me. Absolutely. Thank you and thank you. And I wanted to ask one question though. That thing about God can't drive a parked car? What was the verb? God can't what?
Even God can't drive a parked car.
Thank you. Thank you. God works through people.
God put in drive.
So that was awesome. And Janine.
Hi, I'm Janine. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Janine.
Okay. Most important, white check, 24 hours, surrender check.
Woo-hoo!
All right.
It's yours.
30 days. 60? 90?
All right. Woo-hoo.
6 months. 9 months. A year or multiple.
Hey everybody, I'm Tim, an alcoholic.
Hey Tim.
This is Tim, him, and he's my sponsor, and we met here at the speaker meeting. He hasn't been to this meeting since Derek W. told his story, which was New Year's. His father had a serious situation and had to go to the hospital about his heart, sent him home to face hospice, and he went well over a month. And so Tim's been on a vigil, and you know what? It's the best thing that Tim's gone through in quite some time. It was really powerful. And this is his first night back, his first opportunity to pick up a chip, and I believe it's 21 years.
21.
Yes.
I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tim.
So good to be back here. Thank you, Todd. I really enjoyed it. This has been my home group for, I think, 19 years. Somebody told me early on, commit yourself to something and commit yourself to a meeting. And I did that here. Now, Tim's done the heavy lifting for many years, but we work together. I love this meeting. We've heard hundreds of great stories. AA has just done so much for me. I mean, it's been very good to me, and you people have been very good to me. And to recap what Tim said, my father is 90 years old in January 30, went in the hospital. They sent him home to pass on January 9th. There's nothing they could do for him. I took FMLA, and I've been staying with him, sleeping beside him on a rollaway bed, and it was a very peaceful passing. He had his 91st birthday, January 20th. Never had any pain, and I was there when he passed away. And I got to talk to him, and since my mother died 6 years ago, I've taken him to appointments. I've done all his driving. He's a minister, and he speaks at a lot of different places. I drove him, and I handled all his affairs. I handled his bills. I handled his, you know, financial affairs. And, you know, the times he came and bailed me out of jail several times, the nights he spent, it doesn't make up for that. But I'm glad I got to do a little bit, you know, through the years. And it's just amazing how he depended on me for the last few years of his life. Nothing I know of but AA can do that. You know, thank all of you, and I encourage you to hang around. I was not capable of understanding the promises when I came into AA. What I heard was get sober, win prizes. But it's so much more than that. I don't even think I was capable of understanding what the promises are. Thank y'all a lot.
Okay. I'm going to offer this one more time for anyone, because it's the most important one. Anyone? Okay.
Good job.
Yay.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Congratulations to your lady who got the white chip. Congratulations to you. And please stick around after the meeting. I'm so happy that I know I can't do this by myself, and I need you. So, and again, thank you, Todd. Awesome. Awesome job.
Surrender was the last thing I wanted to do. There ain't no denying the pain you put me through. I thought I knew you so well. Guess I have to blame myself for letting you burn me till I was head down, hellbound, digging that hole, and my soul got tired, wound up, burned out. Devil turned a good girl into a liar. I didn't come here looking for the light. No, no, I came in here running from the fire. Heartbreaker, you had me believe that you love me, but you gave me one match in gasoline. It all happened so fast, nothing was left but ashes. I should have seen it coming, but I was head down, hell bound, digging that hole and my soul got tired, wound up, burned out. The devil turned a good girl into a liar. I didn't come here looking for the light, no, no, I came in here running from the fire. From the fire.